It was pain that knocked upon my door and said that she had come to stay. And though I would not welcome her but bade her go away, she entered in, and like my own shade, she followed after me. And from her stabbing, stinging sword, no moment was I free. There are troubles that won't go away, plaguing our wretched souls until we feel bruised with adversity. To some extent, that describes every one of us at some points in life. All of you have been bruised by adversity, and some of you very recently. David said, "Many are the afflictions of the righteous." Job said, "Man's days are short-lived and full of trouble." Paul said, "We are perplexed, persecuted, knocked down." In fact, if we were to trace the journeys of Paul through the first century, it would be like tracing the path of a wounded deer running from the hunter, one bloody mark after another. Peter said, "Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened unto you." The Bible is replete with illustrations of the reality of hurt and trouble. The drum of man beats out the pulse of pain. A jeweler gives as one of the surest tests for a true diamond the water test. I'm told that an imitation stone is not as brilliant as the genuine, but you can't tell by looking. But a genuine diamond sparkles brilliantly, even though underwater, while the imitation is practically extinguished as to its sparkle. Many who are confident of their faith, when they find themselves under the water of sorrow or affliction, find that their faith does not shine forth as brilliantly as they had hoped. But you put true, solid faith under that same water, and it shines forth as brilliantly as ever. G.K. Chesterton said, "I believe in getting into hot water. I think it keeps you clean." There is a need in our lives for a testing. Sometimes there's no better test than hot water, the water of sorrows and trials. Because the way we handle troubles is an indication of our faith. And we experience trouble constantly. Seems like it's never far away. Job said, "Man is born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward." Again, he said, "Man that is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. Be not far from me, for trouble is near me," said the psalmist in Psalm 22. Ecclesiastes said, "Therefore I hated life, because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit." Paul said, "If you get married, you'll have trouble, because you have trouble just being you and trying to just be you with somebody who's trying to be them." It's certainly going to cause some trouble. Jesus flatly said, "In this world you will have tribulation." And he himself was troubled in spirit, John 13, 21. Paul said, "We're troubled on every side," 2 Corinthians 4, verse 8. So we expect trouble. You're not the only one going through it. We could start over here and go across the room, and everybody could tell what their troubles are. If your faith is no good for trouble, it's no good. If your faith is only good when you don't need it, you don't need it. If my faith is only good when all is well, it's not well. So we have this first chapter of James, and I appreciate Rick reading that for us. Nancy has printed verses 2 through 4, which is the crux of our lesson this morning. James 1, verse 2, when you fall into various trials, variegated trials. The idea is that of something that's multicolored or polka-dotted. It emphasizes the diversity of the troubles rather than the number of them. All shapes, sizes, and varieties of trouble. And he says, when, not if, when you fall into various trials, because this is as inevitable as the proverbial taxes and death. I heard a story about a man who was on his way home in a subway. He was prone to motion sickness to begin with, and he'd had a big lunch, and he'd worked already all afternoon with a bit of an upset stomach. And he was jammed into this subway as the last person able to cram himself on, and the door closed, and he was there in the doorway, facing out, looking through the window as things were flashing by at 90 miles an hour. And the longer he stood there, the sicker he got, until they came to a stop that was not his place to get off, but another man was waiting on the platform at the head of the line to get on. And the door opened, and out came the first man's lunch all over the first guy in line. And then the door shut, and the train went right on. And the man on the platform, who had the other guy's lunch all over him, turned to the guy behind him in line and said, "Why me?" And isn't that the way that life so often seems? That the most unexpected things will happen, the most weirdly coincidental things will happen to you, and you just think, "Why me? Why this? Why now?" But James says that trials are inevitable. If the subway door has not opened on you recently, it will. That's what he's talking about here when he says that trials have a purpose. In verse 3, he says, "The trying of your faith works patience," that is, steadfast endurance. There are specific tests to stretch us spiritually. Trials teach us how to hang in there when it seems like there's no good answer. It's possible to be in the habit of taking tests as personal offenses. But if we can look at these tests as something intended to teach us, we'll be way ahead. Our faith is tested like a rubber band is tested, and that is by stretching, and it either breaks or it gets more flexible. Same with us. We either break under the stress or we get a little more flexible. We start to give a little where we didn't before. And by, the Lord hopes that we will be patient, that is, enduring under the load. He says in verse 3 that the trying of your faith, the testing of your faith, the original word is docimus, which is the word for approval. Many of the jugs and pots that we've dug up archaeologically were marked with this word, docimos, which is expressing approval of a vessel that went through the furnace without cracking. The vessels that cracked in the furnace were placed on the budget shelf and sold for much less. But those that were valuable were those that were approved through the furnace. A swimming instructor works all summer with the children, and then the day of testing comes, and the instructor puts the child in the water, not to see him sink, not to disapprove the child, but to see that child swim successfully. So James says in verse 4, let patience, let endurance have its perfect result. It's like stacking up a row of dominoes, and then you push the first one over, and they all fall. The finger of testing pushes the first one, and when endurance goes down, it bumps into the domino of maturity, and if maturity stays on course, then we become eventually a person of deep character. Some of you have known people of great, deep Christian character, and they were all people who learned how to handle life in the furnace. The mother who is able to say, "The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." The father who comes home having done his best, but having lost his job, who says to his family, "Let's thank God for this opportunity to trust him." The teenager who says, "I will not give up my principles. I'm going to maintain my standards, even though right now I feel like I'm not liked by anybody." This marvelous quality of maturity begins to emerge when we're patient under the load. So we can think of troubles not as an enemy, but as a servant for patience and ultimately for character development unto maturity. And this is what we need to do. How can I rise above my situation? I don't want to drop out or quit. I don't want to stop short. But what will help me handle troubling circumstances? How can I become that winner in verse 12 who happily receives the crown of life? When I go through a trial, I need to examine how I react to that trial and what that says about my faith and my love for God, which is also at the end of verse 12, to them that love God. Loving God is the key to enduring all the trials of life. Them that love God is it's a title for Christians, as we have in Romans 8, 28. All things work together to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. Love holds them fast. If a person in their supposed love for God has no ultimate regard except for his own happiness, if we delight in God not for what God is, but for what he is just to us, in such a sentiment, there's no solid virtue. There's a lot of love for self, but no deep love of God. But when God himself becomes the object of devout and delightful contemplation, the views of the lover of God are in great measure diverted from himself. In other words, we get our mind off of ourselves. That's one great thing about coming together like this. It helps us to get our minds off of ourselves. And our soul cleaves to God. And in the fervor of our affection for God, we can often say, like David did, "Whom have I in heaven but thee, God?" As the heart pants after the water brook, so my soul pants after thee, O God. The bond that ties us to God is love, not just a superficial affection, not just sentiment that's basically selfish, that says, as long as I get from God what I want, I'll stick around. But it's a bond of love that can endure any trial. So ask yourself, who do you love more than you love God? Are you pleased with the character of God? Do you love every part of it? Do you love his holiness as well as his grace? Do you love his justice as well as his mercy? In whose character do you behold more beauty than in God's? To whom are you more grateful than you are to God? Supreme love of God is decisive evidence that you're facing in the right direction. How can we gain the most from trials? We've all got them, that's a given. But how are we going to respond to them? And how can we gain the most from them? James here gives us three means to persevering through them, to rising above them, to gaining the most from them, and ultimately winning the victory. Number one is a joyous attitude. You've got the problem anyway, but what's your attitude going to be about it? Like Viktor Frankl said when he was in that concentration camp, he was a Jewish psychiatrist during the Second World War. They put him in a concentration camp. And he said, the only thing I had control of while I was there, because everybody else was making all my decisions, when I would work, what work would I do, what I would eat, if I would eat, when I could sleep, or if I could sleep. He said, I had one choice I made every day, and that was I got to pick my own attitude. Nobody could do that for me. And James says, have a joyous attitude. When you fall into various trials, have a joyous attitude. My brethren, count it all joy. To count means to consider, to evaluate. Discipline yourself to do it. It's a conscious commitment. Paul said, I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. He said that right after he said, rejoice always, and again I say rejoice. And Paul said that while he was a prisoner. He cultivated that contentment. It didn't happen by accident. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. This is like an unplanned thing. It's surprising. Like at the end of the book of Acts where Paul's ship fell into a place where two seas met. Same idea here. It's an inadvertent occurrence. There's no way out because these things surround you. There's no exit in any direction, except the ones you can't see with your eyes. Jesus did not seek trouble, but he accepted it when it came. Hebrews 12, verse 2, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. He looked beyond the trial to the joy to be realized after the trial. In other words, what the enduring of that trial would accomplish. In verses 10 and 11 of Hebrews 12, he says that no chastening for the present seems to be joyous but grievous. Nevertheless, afterwards, that's the key word there. Nevertheless, afterwards, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. So we count it a privilege to have our faith tested. We anticipate what the perfecting work is that can be done through that trial. And we learn to cultivate that right attitude. As the Apostle Peter said, after you have suffered a while, then these good things result. Jesus said his disciples should not expect anything different than what he had endured. Is the servant greater than his Lord? If they hated me, they'll hate you. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you. So look beyond the trial to the joy that will come when you have passed the test and you can start experiencing the joy already. And it's not a partial joy. Count it all joy. Having once come to a settled conviction that we're going to face trials with the right attitude. Have you noticed, as I have, that in trials, you're more aware of God? In trials, probably prayer increases. In trials, maybe your study of the Bible increases. Paul in jail said, I do rejoice and I will rejoice. Job said, when God has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And Job's wife was waiting in the wings saying, why don't you just curse God and die? He didn't get a lot of help from her. But Job is rejoicing. Romans 8:18, the sufferings of this present time are not even worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Our values determine our evaluations. If we value comfort more than character, then trials are invariably going to upset us. If we value the material more than the spiritual, we're not going to be able to count it all joy. If we live only for the present and forget the future, then trials will make us bitter, not better. If you cannot rejoice in your trials, your values are wrong. Pressed out of measure and pressed to all length, pressed so intensely it seems beyond strength, pressed in the body and pressed in the soul, pressed in the mind till the dark surges roll. Pressure by foes and pressure by friends. Pressure on pressure till life nearly ends. Pressed into loving the staff and the rod. Pressed into knowing no helper but God. Pressed into liberty where nothing clings. Pressed into faith for impossible things. Pressed into living a life in the Lord. Pressed into living a Christ life outpoured. Hast thou no scar? No hidden scar on foot or side or hand? I hear thee sung as mighty in the land. I hear them hail thy bright ascendant star. Hast thou no scar? Hast thou no wound? Yet I was wounded by the archers, spent, leaned me against the tree to die, and rent by ravening beasts that compassed me, I swooned. Hast thou no wound? No wound, no scar. Yet as the master shall the servant be, and pierced are the feet that follow me, but thine are whole. Can he have followed far who has no wound and no scar? The joy and privilege of bearing in our bodies the marks of the Lord Jesus, of enduring trials unto maturity with a joyous attitude, contrary to our normal response, which is, why me? Why this? Why now? A joyous attitude can take you a long way in the right direction. The trial exists anyway. You pick your attitude about it. Number two is an understanding mind, and this is in verse 3 where he says, knowing. Knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. knowing this. That speaks of the mind. Know that what's going on in your trials is producing something beneficial in you. Know that you're being tested. The verification of true faith is a wonderful thing. Don't ever think that trials don't accomplish anything. They do if you use them well. You can use them as stumbling stones or stepping stones to something better. The test is not for your bad, the test is for your good. The swimming teacher doesn't want the child to drown, but he's got to put him in the water to see if they can swim. He wants them to pass the test. The potter doesn't say, hey, let's turn up the heat and see how much heat this vessel can take before it cracks. No, he says, great, it's not cracking. Let's get it done and bring it out so that it doesn't crack. When the furnace cools down, he lifts it out with pleasure, and it is approved. Just as David said, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers. And David actually came to look at King Saul as a tool to teach David some things that he needed to learn. Trials are tools to teach us endurance, to teach us staying power and perseverance, and the tenacity of spirit that holds on under pressure. Every time you successfully pass through such a trial, you are strengthened and you gained a little more endurance. And James says, know that. Don't be ignorant of that. Psalm 40, verse 1, I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined unto me. He heard my cry. He brought me up out of a horrible pit, out of the miry clay, and set my feet on a rock. He established my goings, and he put a new song in my mouth. Isn't that the way you feel when you've come through? You feel stronger than ever because of the enduring of that trial. As we have in 1 Corinthians 10:13, there's no trial that has taken you but what is common to man. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that which you are able to bear. Does everybody have the same ability to bear trials? No. A brand new baby Christian is not going to have the same ability that some of us should. But God will never allow any one of us to face a trial that we can't handle. Sometimes we feel like God thinks we're a lot stronger than we think we are, but God knows more about it than we do. Remember, the more difficult the battle is, the sweeter the victory is. Like with Moses in Hebrews 11, by faith Moses, when he was come to years, he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Why? Because he had respect unto the recompense of reward. Moses had an understanding mind. He knew what enduring the afflictions would bring in the future. So he endured the wrath of the king because by faith he saw an invisible king that was above any Pharaoh. By faith, we have an understanding mind. And number three is a submissive will. Verse 4 starts with let. Let is submission. Let patience have her perfect work. Let endurance do what God wants it to do. Here's a command demanding submission. The only way out of a trial is through it. There are no side exits. The way out is through. Psalm 131, surely I have behaved and quieted myself like a child that is weaned of its mother. My soul is even as a weaned child. That is, contented. What I've been through has made me grow. I've matured. I'm off the bottle. Maturity is the goal. Let endurance lead to that. The term for perfect was used in secular sources of animals that were full grown. It's used here of Christians who are full grown. Let steadfast endurance have its perfect work and make you full grown, which is possible, Philippians 3:15. Let us therefore, as many as be mature. Maturity is possible in the Christian life. It's attainable. You can get there. The Lord is trying to bring us there. Perfect carries the idea of a richness of character, and it also contains the concept of a balance, a stable, balanced righteousness. Be perfect and entire. The idea of entirety is the concept of holography, a 360-degree picture with all portions intact. It's fully complete. It lacks nothing. You're mature in Christ. That's what Peter's talking about in 1 Peter 5:10. The God of all grace, after you have suffered a while, will make you mature. In Jeremiah 48, verse 11, we read that Moab hath been at ease from his youth. And that what that meant was life was a bowl of cherries for Moab so far. And it had produced in Moab a very weak character. As we go through trials, we are stripped of our worldly dependencies and drawn to God. We are shown the character of our faith and perfected unto Christ-likeness. Soldiers used to say that crosswinds are best for entering a harbor, because it's very difficult to enter a harbor into a headwind, and you try to enter with a tailwind, you can wind 40 feet up on the beach. So the crosswinds are best for that project. You and I are like good metal, and the more we're fired, the more we are refined. The more we are opposed, the more we are approved. Wrongs may try us, wrongs may touch us, but they cannot imprint upon us any false stamp. Trials cannot destroy our faith. They do test it, though. Sufferings are like little chips off the cross of Christ. I will not doubt, though all my ships at sea come drifting home with broken masts and sails, I shall believe the hand which never fails from seeming evil worketh good to me. And though I weep because those sails are battered, still will I cry while my best hopes lie shattered. I trust in thee. I will not doubt, though all my prayers return unanswered from that still white realm above. I shall believe it is an all-wise love which has refused those things for which I yearn. And though at times I cannot keep from grieving, yet the pure ardor of my fixed believing undimmed shall burn. I will not doubt, though sorrows fall like rain and troubles swarm like bees around a hive. I shall believe the heights for which I strive are only reached by anguish and by pain. And though I groan and tremble with my crosses, yet I shall see through my severest losses the greater gain. I will not doubt. Well anchored in the faith, like some staunch ship, my soul braves every gale, so strong its courage that it will not fail to breast the mighty unknown sea of death. Oh, may I cry when body parts with spirit, I do not doubt, so listening worlds may hear it, with my last breath. That's the way to face life, and that's the way to face death, unwaveringly. So let us accept the trials that produce Christ-likeness, that reveal the state of our faith, that humble us, that wean us from the world, that call us to eternal hope, that teach us what we really love, and that teach us how to help each other, and that chasten us to purity. Let's thank God for these trials and count it all joy and understand and submit, confident that no trial comes to us that we can't bear. The worth of a soldier is never known in times of peace. God only had one son without sin, but he has no son without a cross. It pleased the Father to bruise his son. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience through the things which he suffered. If in this quiet moment this morning you've never given your life to the Lord Jesus Christ, because of God's matchless love, he has come to your rescue at the cross. If you will accept his son and yield to his will, that would be a wonderful thing today. We would all rejoice with you. Hearing a message is one thing, but responding in God's way is another. If this is your day to respond, let us know how to assist you by coming forward to the front as we stand together and sing one more song. Britt?